You're listening to Rendezvous with the Writer with Bobby Jean and Jim Bell, only on LA Talk Radio.
Welcome to Rendezvous with a Writer, where readers and writers meet,
and story is everything. We're your hosts,
Jim and Bobby Bell.
And that music that opens and closes our show is from the Hot Texas Swing Band out of Texas, of course, Alex Dormont and the band, and we thank them. I love that we get to listen to a little bit of Hot Texas every week. Jim.
Who's our guest tonight?
Who's our guest tonight? Are you answering?
One of our favorites, Eric Heisner, is here.
Oh, hello, Eric.
Hey, welcome. Great seeing you both.
Oh, it's so good to see you. We've known Eric for so long. We were just talking about how old your kids were when we first met you.
Yeah, I don't even know if they're around yet. They were maybe babies.
Babies. So it's delighted to have you back in the studio with us. We have so many good memories of time on the writer's block, time at the Buckaroo Bookshop. Just wonderful, wonderful memories when we look at your face and hear your voice.
Been a long road.
More to come. More to come. So let's see. You have a little something about Eric?
A little bio here for our listeners out there. Eric Heisner is an award-winning writer, actor, and filmmaker. He prides himself on being hired as a cowboy character who can ride a horse, shoot a gun, deliver his lines, and not fall off. And that says something. He is the author of many Western and adventure novels, including Along to Presidio, Wings of the Pirate, Fire Angels, and the two we'll be talking about tonight, Citation for Murder and Above the Llano.
Wait a minute. Here's Fire Angels. Jim, I'm still learning how to, be Vanna White and show things up in the camera.
Yeah, that's pretty good.
And then we're talking about, I love this book, Citation for Murder. And the other one is Above the Llano. So exciting, a Western, of course. And let's see, we're going to talk about. So, Eric, welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for having me. It's great to see you.
I don't have enough room on the table for all your books. So why don't you tell us a little bit more just about yourself and your background, and then we'll get into Citation for Murder.
All right. Well, I'm a writer and a filmmaker and an actor, but I've been I went to film school in Chicago, and that's where I took a screenwriting class, and I had just a fantastic teacher for screenwriting, and he sparked my interest in writing. And as an actor, you know, a lot of actors complain about, you don't get the right kind of roles. If you don't write it, you're not going to get those kind of roles. So I thought, I need to write the kind of roles I want to be in. They're not making these kind of movies anymore, like the Errol Flynn movies or the John Wayne movies or the Raiders of the Lost Ark type stuff. And so I thought, that those are the kind of stories I'm interested in. So that's what I'm going to write. So I started writing every day back in my 20s when I was in film school. And, so I wrote screenplays for a lot of years. They get optioned and bounce around town and not go anywhere. And then in 2014 is about the time I met you guys. Mm-hmm, and that's when I wrote my first novel. And, a friend of mine said, well, what are you going to do with it? And I said, I have no idea. I know about screenplays and know where to send those off, different competitions. But this one, I sent it off. Oh, he recommended me to a New York publisher. And they said, hey, your timing's perfect. We're looking for Westerns. And nobody's looking for Westerns. So that was great. And that got me up and running. And I kind of wish I would have done it sooner, but I probably wouldn't have been ready to write books sooner. But I really enjoy doing it. And it's, I get up 5:30 every morning, and it's not fun to get up at 5:30, but I do enjoy, once I get into the swing of writing, I do enjoy that. It's like going to the gym early and getting it done and and feeling better. And early in the morning, you're not clouded with all this stuff that you have to do for the day and all the emails and stuff like that. Just that's where my creative.
Yeah. Well, I noticed for once in a while we'd have email conversation back and forth. I said, boy, these emails are early in the morning.
I'm just going to bed. You know, when one comes in from Eric and I look at the time and I go, I need to go to bed. And I'll answer him and hit the hay. When you're writing so early in the morning, it makes me wonder, are you writing on more than one project at a time? Or you just on that one till it's done?
Usually I usually stick with a draft. So right now I have, I'm on a first draft of a screenplay right now. So I'm finishing that up and then I'm going to spring break with the kids, the family next week. And so after that, I'm jumping on, a final edit of a book that comes out this spring. And so I'll be doing, and so then after that, I'll probably jump on like a second or third draft of something else and polish that up. And then I kind of jump from different projects, and sometimes I jump between screenplays and novels because it's kind of like farmers, change up the ground a little bit, plant corn and plant beans, and it refreshes the.
Right. Well, this book Citation, but I'm going to hold it up again. Okay. Let's see if I can get it in the camera. Citation for Murder. And then you say, a neo-noir comedy. So what is a neo-noir comedy?
Yeah, well, I had to kind of, okay, so it's a comedy, but it's a dark comedy. I didn't want to call it a dark comedy. And then I thought, you know, the Philip Marlowe, detective things, those were noir. And the neo-noir are the newer ones. And so it kind of has, it's a dark humor type thing. It rides a fine line between it's not very politically correct. The main character is not politically correct. And so that was a lot of fun to write, to hear his voice come out, and he just says some of the most terrible things about stewardesses or meter maids or whatever. And
but it is 1996.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's kind of the dawn of cell phones, and in LA there was car chases going on. It was the OJ trial. It was reality TV. It was kind of a ridiculous time where people were just, what's going on here? Well, right. And everyone's looking and everyone's getting the attention and the news is going crazy and the news is just eating it up feeding the public. And this, it's just so much information that that was kind of the dawn of all this information that now everyone carries a phone. Back then, I didn't even have a phone.
No, yeah, we didn't. But, I don't know that we did.
Everyone carries a phone, and it's weird if you don't have it on. You know, I leave my phone downstairs a lot of times, and I shut it off when I go to bed, and people, well, what if someone needs to get a hold of you? Well, when I come back around to the phone, I'll get back to you.
Well, you write about, this was really a fun read. And although it's dark because we do have some murders, but there is a lot of, I found humor. Our main character, P.I. Clive Wiltz, when he goes to his office and his secretary Dolores, and I was reading aloud to Jim because he was reading the other book at the time. I would read him sections. He'd say, that's like my camera. And then he'd say, oh, there's a little Magnum. What kind of car is he driving? I'm like, well, it's not a Ferrari.
A Fiero.
You know, Fiero.
It's a poor man's Ferrari.
Yeah, exactly.
He goes, a private eye didn't make any money, right?
Yeah. I grew up on that stuff. I grew up Magnum Guy and Simon and Simon. My mom liked Murder, She Wrote, and so I watched that sometimes Sunday nights. And, TV was different back then, too. You had to, there's a block of TV was on. If you didn't watch it then, you missed it.
You didn't get it.
You never see it again.
Exactly. And then because we did live in L.A., and that's where we met you, and we moved there in 91, so it was kind of fun. This is in 96, and we're placing ourselves there. It's not that long ago. Although it is longer than we like to
technology think, wise, it's a long time ago.
Yes. Yeah. But mentioned places like, Roscoe's chicken and waffles. And there was one in Pasadena. We just loved that place. And so there were, as a reader, there are all kinds of things that were very fun. We remember the first time we went to Santa Monica. Tell us a little bit about the storyline, and how does Santa Monica fit into this storyline?
Well, Well, Santa Monica for me, I used to work for Dustin Hoffman. I'd carry scripts around to the studios for him and occasionally have to pick up his dry cleaning or his kids down in Santa Monica. So I got to know Santa Monica and Brentwood pretty well. And so when I formed this story, I thought, you know, I know that area, and I got some stories, good and bad stories of, you know, experiences down there. And so I kind of worked that into, but the story revolves around this Santa Monica sniper. He has a problem with a meter maid, and he ends up shooting one, and then he goes on this kind of a killing spree. And so Clive Wiltz gets kind of wrapped up in with, because of the media. The media, he was on a big case a decade ago, and so they see him in the vicinity, and they think, well, he must be on the case again. And the police don't really want him anywhere near it, and then they kind of come around and they kind of use him as bait. And he kind of bumbles his way through, so he's kind of a Magnum PI, Big Lebowski type or something.
And of course, a storage unit becomes important. We don't want to do any spoiler alerts, but it's like, oh yeah, that was probably the dawn of all the big storage, you know, places.
Well, I had an idea. I remember a friend left town at one time and he wanted to store his car. And he said, well, he needed to figure out where to park it. And he went to a storage facility and he could pull his car right into it. And I thought, this is cool. You can drive your car into this place and just park your car in it like a parking garage and pull the door down and leave all your stuff in there.
Yeah.
And that's what he did. So that was always in the back of my mind for the last 20 years or something. And put a little action sequence in there.
So, so the public kind of get a little tired of the parking situation. And having lived there and ventured into Santa Monica a couple of times and other places as well. I think even Rodeo Drive has some challenges. Tell us about, for those that don't know LA, what's going on with the signs for parking?
Oh my gosh. You know, you wonder how many signs can you put up on an 8-foot pole, and it looks like it's about 6 or 7 you can stack on there. You know, no parking between 2 and 4 on Tuesday, Thursday, and Saturday. Only parking permits 6, 4, 3, and it's just ridiculous all the signs they put up. And I found it interesting during COVID, they actually stopped putting out parking tickets for about a year.
They did
parking tickets, because of COVID. So.
Well, people weren't going anywhere.
Yeah, maybe the sequel will take place during COVID.
I mean, some people, we still could get out and do some shopping and things like that, but certainly people weren't, you know, and there was probably more people working out of the home and all. I mean, that's really interesting. Yeah. So this was a little different genre for you to write in. So how did you decide to kind of change hats and kind of get into the private eye world and write in a different genre?
It's something that I've always enjoyed, and I the Western is kind of my bread and butter, the Western and the adventure stories. And I thought, you know, how can I, you know, I had the Western come out in the spring, and that one did so well. I thought, you know, I need to fit in this other one. And I knew it wasn't going to sell as well, and it hasn't sold near as well as my Westerns, but it's something that excites me. And I think there's some readers out there like, oh, it's nice to, you know, see something a little different, not just the same, you know, Western characters. And I also have some filmmaking friends, and I thought, you know, this one might, you know, interest my filmmaking friends a little bit more. A lot of old friends in LA, I thought, you know, so it's kind of a little homage to them, you know, some time in LA, because anyone that's lived in LA is going to recognize going to the observatory
and
a lot of familiar places.
In that room.
Yeah. So it's the Thomas Guide.
For me, it was kind of a fun vacation in LA to spend the year and a half writing that one.
Since you're mentioning friends that are also in film and screenwriting, one thing that that right off the top of you know, the first page as a reader, and Jim discovered it too, it's written in the present tense.
Yeah, well, it's
which is
I don't that's where I write most of my stories, and it's probably because I come from a screenwriting background. I don't think too much about it. I think of myself, I'm probably not a great writer, but I'm a pretty good storyteller. So I'm a visual storyteller as well. So I guess I write what comes out, and that's the way it comes out. And, you know, my editor, he's like, you know, if you stick to it and you go for it 100%, you know, it works. So
reading in the present tense, cause I can't think of anything I've read. We've read multiple points of view and things like that. but it
just
makes
it. You read a book
it,
a week, right?
Yeah, we read a, yeah, well, in this case, too.
Yeah. Well, we do a little speed reading.
Well, not really. but it was interesting because what it does is it makes you feel like you are watching it on the screen. You're watching it in real time. You go to the movies and you're, even if it's something that's about the Crusades, you know, it's happening.
Yeah.
It's happening like it's, they're not talking in the past right, tense right. to each other in dialogue and all, yeah. you know? So I thought this is actually really kind of fun to be reading in the present yeah. tense.
Yeah. And the same and with I've had a lot of people say they enjoyed it. And I've had a few people say they didn't enjoy it. They couldn't get into it. And,
oh, you know, interesting.
It's everyone's personal taste. And, you know, some yeah. people, yeah. you know, some people don't even notice. So,
yes.
That
now,
is, that's true, too.
There, this is a standalone.
Yeah.
And I did wonder about a sequel, but I'm also wondering about a prequel because there are references to the history, huh? thing that put him on the map in the news in 1984, yeah. or the billionaire baby Barlow case.
Well, that was back when he was in his prime. He didn't have the paunch. And,
well, you know. Well, and there's some references to a boat, and there's... conversation with Detective Buckley.
Yeah.
And I kept thinking, am I missing something? And I thought, oh, you need a prequel. We need to meet him on his first case or the case that led up
yeah.
to the first case. So do you have any plans on continuing this series?
I there's probably one brewing. Right now I kind of have my ideas stacked up for the next few years. So that one, it's kind of, it would be a while. It'll I'm just right now a sequel to T.H. Oakman.
Okay.
And I looked and that one came out in 2016.
Right.
And, you know, I'm working on that story. And so it'll probably be another year or two before that comes out. So,
okay.
Yeah, I hate to put 10 years between.
He'll be his grandson in the detective agency with him. So if yeah. you were to cast this, do you have somebody in mind that would be perfect for Private Eye?
He's definitely a Paul Giamatti type. Paul Giamatti, or, you know, I grew up with, you know, Clint Howard, Ron Howard's little brother. He's yeah. probably too old for it now, but someone that's, yeah. you know, not conventional, yeah. you know, yeah, for, okay. for him, he looks in the mirror, yeah. he sees Magna
yeah.
P.I.,
yeah.
but in reality, he looks more like Paul Giamatti. Yeah.
And so does the gal in the coffee shop, Marianne, right?
Yeah.
Well, we've been talking with our guest, who it's just so fun. We've just been blessed to have known Eric for so many years. It's just fun. Of course, I'm going to cough. We've been talking about, Eric, what's the name of the book?
Citation for Murder.
Thank you.
L.A. Neo-Noir.
We're going to take a very quick break to show you where you can get all of Eric's books. And when we come back, we're going to shift gears and go to the Old West when we come back. Story is everything. Find a great one on Out West Shop's bookshop. Go to outwestshop.com, find books and CDs on the menu, choose Shop Out West on bookshop.org. Browse through featured authors on Rendezvous with a Writer. Explore curated book lists and our featured picks. Add in note cards, calendars, and jigsaw puzzles. One-stop shopping for great gifts. Use the search box to find thousands more titles. Make the switch. Your purchase supports us as independent booksellers. That's our story.
Welcome back. Welcome back to Rendezvous with the Writers. Special guest, Eric Heiser. Before we shift to the West, you know, there's a lot of neat illustrations
we didn't,
in here.
Yes, there are.
And this is this wonderful car that our detective is driving.
Here.
Oh, yeah. The Fiero. The 1987 Fiero.
Did I get it in the camera?
Yep,
yeah.
That's it.
Okay. And who is that? Do you want to talk about the illustrator?
Yeah, who's, well, who's the
my
illustrator?
Daughter, actually.
There you go.
This one. Yeah.
So yeah, she's there's a picture of her in the back here. You know, I was remembering one time that your wife was there,
Amber,
with the children. Yeah. I swear we were talking about 6 and 8 years old, maybe or something. I can't remember. For
we
sure.
have pictures from one of the cowboy festivals with all of you in the
absolutely
in the
amazing. As time goes by,
they grow up quick.
So we are now. Heading
in the West.
For The Old West. And the next book is, do you want to announce the title?
Above the Llano.
There you go.
I didn't know we were saying it another time.
My old friend Al Bringus, he did the illustrations for this one.
Yes, he did.
Yes.
And so he's done probably 5 or 6 of my books.
Yes, he has. He's a neat guy.
And here's the one of the I don't know. Do I have it in the camera?
Yep. That's
okay.
Perfect.
Good. Why don't you tell our listeners what they're looking at?
So that's the fancy engraved six shooter that the kid ends up getting in Seven Fingers of Brazos. Yeah, Seven Fingers of Brazos. He gets that in the West of Bravo series. There's the first one, West of Bravo, and the second one, Seven Fingers of Brazos, introduces us to this kid, Jules, and that Holton takes under his wing. And then this third one continues their adventure, and Jules is in Texas running around with some Texas Rangers, and Holton goes back to Arizona to his ranch and finds Bear there with this gal that he had put on the trail. He was supposed to take her to a town, but he ended up taking her to the ranch instead. So there's,
well, that was Alice we're talking Alice. About. And Alice is a pretty independent woman. Is
she's a tough one.
You know, she is.
She's a velvet hammer. That's what she is.
She kind of likes to do what she wants to do, and doesn't really worry about what other people think. And she obviously has a past because there was a reference to a couple of children. So obviously we have a dark history, perhaps, in there someplace.
Well, she from Seven Fingers of Brazos, the second novel, she's one of the gals that gets rescued when they're searching for the two sisters. They come across some prisoners, and she's one of the ones that gets rescued. And so,
this is part of a series.
Yes. And you can read them independently, and you just kind of get those tidbits of the history there, and you're not quite sure. But if you
here's another main character.
That's Holton there.
Yeah, that's our main guy, Holton. Well,
what's Holton all about? What's he like?
Well, he's, for me, when I first started writing it, you know, West of Bravo was my very first novel. And I thought, you know, what kind of Western character do I want to, because I knew from screenplays that when you, it's not just writing, it's the rewriting and the rewriting. And you better have someone that you really want to revisit again and again. Otherwise, you're going to get sick of it. And so I thought of he's a Gary Cooper, Randolph Scott, John Wayne type character. He's clad in buckskins. He's got his dog with him. He's actually a half breed. He has an Indian mother and a white father that was a trader. And he's got this dog that runs around with him, and he's a bit of a loner. He had some trauma in the first book, and he reluctantly gets a crowd of people that come to rely on him, and but he'd rather just be traveling with dog, I think.
Yeah,
he leaves dog with the boy, and he's missing him and talking to him, and kind of cursing himself for talking to a dog.
That's and he knows he knows how to sew.
Yeah, when we talk about dog, he is really a main character in this story.
Yeah, and it's, you know, I'm an animal lover, and Al Bringus, man, he's. When I see his relationship with his dog, and you know, he treats him like a kid, and it's kind of a cool thing. And dogs, they love you no matter what. And so it's kind of, they're very loyal animals, and it's kind of nice to have that in there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and this dog has a special ability to sniff out Indians.
What's that all about?
he's like a warning alarm. Yeah,
he saved your life several times.
Yeah, well, Holton, he grew up with the Apaches, and he grew up at the fort, and then he has quite a few run-ins with different natives, good ones and bad ones, and the Apache, and I think in this one the Comanche. He has a run-in with.
And, I think Comanche, kind of in the beginning, that was a really wonderful, very visual scene. His horse is. Taken while he's, you know, sleeping, and then he's
that's dog's fault. Yeah, dog's supposed to warn him.
Yeah, and he's just okay. I gotta go get my horse. He's not, you know, he's been through it all. I mean, you just have a sense that he will know how to do it, and how to find, and how to get the horse back. It's just a nuisance.
Yeah, and for the natives, it's like counting coup. You know, it's for them, it's a challenge. Hey, if you know, let's go steal these horses, and you know, it wasn't anything personal, and they yeah. weren't after him. They thought, okay, yeah. we're going to take this horse, and it's a nice horse, and
yeah,
and so, but yep. he's going to have to go steal it back.
Yep. And then he comes home after being away for a while, and there's squatters yeah. on his property. Oh, geez. Nothing like coming home and fighting squatters on your property.
They're the ones that are shooting at
and
you.
And they're shooting at you.
Yeah.
Yeah. So there's a lot of action. There's a lot of action in this book.
Do you have total control on these characters, Eric, or do they surprise you once in a while?
They actually surprise me a lot. I kind of know where we're going, and the dialogue comes out of, yeah. you know, I establish the characters and the relationship, and a lot of times they do surprise me. And that's kind of the joy of writing. I don't have it too, you know, I'm a screenwriter too. So I kind of map things out the way I want. I know in which direction we're going. And then the dialogue comes out yeah. of the situations and the action, all the action sequences. I don't have those planned out, and they just kind of flesh themselves out. You know, through the rewrites, and I write them again and again. And, yeah. and I try to think of things that mm-hmm. I haven't seen before or heard before and work those things in. And it's a lot of fun.
Mm-hmm. You know, I want to ask you about the title again. And this is more for me, but maybe for our listeners also is what's the Llano?
Well, the Llano is, yeah. it's a river in Texas. It runs
okay.
From Northwest Texas and down towards Austin. And so this story takes place, Enchanted Rock is an area in the Texas Hill Country. And this is kind of where the story takes place. And then they move north up towards Mason County and Llano County. And that's, there's some Longhorn caves up there, and there's some actual caves that the Indians stayed in. And it's kind of a really, Texas has a lot of different landscapes, but the hill country for me is just a beautiful area, you know, full of sandy creeks and caves and bigger rivers, and it's rolling hills. It's a real pretty area. Mm-hmm. So the first book took place in West Texas, and then they kind of cross over to Arizona a little bit, and then the second one took place in North Texas by the Brazos, and then this one's more by the hill country where the Texas Rangers were mm-hmm. kind of within Texas riding Rangers. Distance of Austin. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. What year generally?
It's probably mid 1870s, yeah. mid to late 1870s.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And if you were casting, there's a young man, Jules, what a neat kid who's, you know, wants to be, was with those two Texas Rangers. Do you have a sense of who you would cast as Jules?
Well, when I'm writing, I see him pretty clear because he lives in my house. I got a little boy that's he's quite the trooper, August, and I just see how tough and smart he is, and then you know, a lot of him goes into that character, and it's kind of neat. You know, when I introduced him in the second book, I actually, for me, it was one of my favorite books, and but there were some really bad characters in there, and they did some really bad things, and I didn't, you know, I just let them do what they're going to do. Mm-hmm. And then I shared the book with my dad, and it wasn't, I thought, oh, he's going to really enjoy this father son relationship that Holton's building. And my dad, he's more of a fan of the 1950s and 60s Westerns. And this one just got too mean for him. And he didn't enjoy that part. Mm-hmm. But, that kid character, he's a real tough kid, and very self-reliant, mm-hmm. and he knows yeah. he knows what he wants to do, and he does it. And mm-hmm. so it's
how old is he in this story?
I'd say the kid's probably about 14 years old in this story. So okay. when you first meet him, he's probably a 12-year-old.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he's okay. You know, he's wise beyond his ages. He's like a 20 to me as a Marine. That he was acting like a 21 or 20.
Yeah, when you see terrible things, you grow up in a yeah. hurry, and it's and they kind of mention that they're like, you know, the kid's kind of realizing that, you know, he's realizing that, you know, I've seen, you know, I'm not a normal kid. I've seen some terrible things. I've done some terrible right. things, and that kind of stuff makes you grow up real quick. Mm-hmm. And, you know, on the frontier, the people, they were always trying to survive. People grew up a lot quicker when you had
yes,
you
did. Just
go to town and get yes, a meal. Yeah. You had to mm-hmm. hunt your food, and you had to grow your food, and you had to, you know, watch out for whether it be bandits or hostiles or whatever. Mm-hmm. And it's, it makes you, makes you a lot harder.
Yeah, it does. You're developing another kid in the story. We call him a kid. I think he's Willie.
Yeah.
You know? And he's going to be an amazing kid himself because he has just went through one of the most horrific things that can ever happen. So he's...
And then he sees Jules as a kid kind of his age. Yeah. You know, just a few years. And he looks up to him, and Jules kind of sees this kid and sees a reflection of himself.
Yes, he does.
Kind of what he's gone through. So it's, you know, they've had some trauma.
Mm-hmm. Yes, for sure.
Mm-hmm.
For sure.
Is writing dialogue, does that come easily? And do you say it out loud to just hear what it would sound like and talk a little bit about writing dialogue?
Yeah, I just write what the voice is in my head.
Tell you, write this.
Okay.
I do enjoy dialogue, and that's something coming from my screenwriting, because all the story has to come out in the dialogue and in screenwriting. If it's not, if it's not being spoken, it's all visual storytelling, and then what in the dialogue, all that, the history on all the nuances have to come out through the dialogue.
Mm-hmm.
So, I enjoy teaching dialogue a lot too.
Did you have to do any kind of research for this book?
I do like to travel to the locations. Okay. So I wrote this one during COVID, and the kids were out of school. Well, they were at home schooled, and they were just starting to figure it out. So they had like a half day of school. And so we went out, the kids and I went out to Enchanted Rock with our bandanas on and did some hiking out there. And for them, it was just being outdoors and checking things out. For me, I'm paying attention to what kind of rocks they have here and the kind of trees and the grasses and the and what it feels like to be out there, if you're camping out there, if you're riding through the territory. So I do like to research that. I'm actually doing a road trip this spring, and I'll be traveling kind of between Prescott and this area, and for another story that's brewing.
Oh, cool. Did you have other questions about I did not get all the way through the book. I will, because I'm enjoying it tremendously, but I know that Jim did read cover to cover, and you really enjoyed it. Did you have other questions?
Well, our Holton guy, I tell you, he's tough as nails. He's a man of very few words. Kind of like he goes through life from spot to spot looking for adventure, and he sort of, in some cases, kind of turns his back on what's happened in the past. It just moves forward.
Is he looking for adventure, or does it follow him? Is he like Linus in the, you know, with the
he's not afraid to face it. You know,
he's not afraid of it.
He's not one to put down roots, and so it seems like he comes into these situations a lot. And then his friend Bear, who's more gregarious, I think of him kind of like Jim Christina. He really kind of that booming voice and just that presence.
He
doesn't have to talk when Bear's around.
So. Yeah. I actually thought about Jim reading this book. I know how much he would have enjoyed this book, and he would love to be talking to you about it.
Well, Bear is like a mountain man, you know. He's really, he's just, obviously, officially, I think he's a scout. But to me, he's more like a mountain man.
Yeah, and I'm assuming he, again, no spoiler alerts, he takes a pretty wrenching gunshot happened to him pretty early on in the book, and appears to recover. He has good nursing from Alice. But it takes time.
Wounds were serious business back then.
I thank you for again, I didn't know if he'd make it to the end of the story, but I thanked you for letting him not just be taken out at that time, that we got more with him and we got to see kind of Alice in many ways taking care, and we got to see Bear beginning to come back again. And I liked that. Again, I didn't know what would happen eventually, but I liked that you didn't remove him from the story early on. He rounds out
Holton well.
He's like his sidekick.
Yeah, and he sees the connection between Alice and he doesn't want to he doesn't want to be a burden. He's but he can't really go take care of himself yet. Yeah. He's still laid up and so that kind of adds some humor there, having him in the as a third wheel.
Well, we're talking, we've been talking about this book. We're going to hold it up again, Above Llano, by our guest, Eric Heisner. And we're going to take a quick break. We're going to hear a little bit about Out West Shop. And when we come back, we're going to talk a little bit more about Gemini Ranch. And if time, about your writing, a little more on your writing process. We'll be right back.
Here at the Out West Shop, we're passionate about the American West, the truth and the myth. We're purveyors of fine Western goods. We scout for unique and distinctive apparel, accessories, home decor, and general merchandise that are a reflection of the Western lifestyle. We hunt for unique artisans and craftsmen who are inspired to create decorative art you can wear based on their own love for the story of the West. We round it up and bring it to you. Check out OutWestShop.com when you need anything Western.
Welcome back. Welcome back to Rendezvous with the Writer. With a special guest, Eric Heisner. We're having a great time tonight.
That was really fun.
We got about 40 books around here. We're talking
we actually still have a little more time, I'm excited to say. So do you want to ask him the movie ranch question?
The movie ranch
question. The movie ranch question.
Yeah, what's, well, you talk to us about that.
Yeah.
So, well, I'm a filmmaker, and during COVID, you know, things shut down in Los Angeles, and we had moved to Austin about 5 years ago. And we kept our place in Los Angeles for me to go back for work. And I did a few movies. I did a movie with Peter Schreiko called Outlaw Johnny Black, which hasn't come out yet. It's going to be an exciting movie. It's going to be the funniest thing since Blazing Saddles. So I got to work with Peter on that and do a lot of horseback riding. And But I think that was the last project I did in LA before things shut down. And so we decided to sell our property there. And I thought, well, you know, we can put it back into our house here in Texas, or let's do something that the whole family will enjoy. So we went searching for ranches, and we knew we wanted a ranch eventually, but we thought it'd be like 10 years down the road. So it moved it up on the timeline. So we found a property that we all liked, and it was, it's got some sandy creeks in it and some great rocks, and looks a little bit like Lone Pine for me. Oh. And, so we got the ranch, and you know, it doesn't have any buildings on it. We put up a glamping tent so the whole family can camp out there. And then I started doing this little Western series called Rio Concho. A friend of mine actually has a feature film that he was doing, and it's taken him probably about 2 years because he's doing it piece by piece. And that inspired me. I thought, you know, I can do something like an old Western serial. Just do piece by piece. It doesn't have to be big budget. I can just pool my resources, and I have the land. I can build sets. I can do all this stuff. So over the last 2 years, I've been building some sets, and we've been filming some segments. And so now we have other location scouts coming to look at the ranch to film other projects there.
That's great.
And so, you know, they'll build sets and hopefully leave them, and we'll just build from there. And it's, for me, it's, you know, I write in the mornings. I get up early and write, and I'll write till probably 8 or 9 o'clock. Mm-hmm. And then if I don't have a bunch of marketing or other emails to answer, I can go to the ranch for the day, and I can work on stuff, clear brush, work on sets, or just, you know, drive around and plan out, you know, kind of location scout out there. It's 168 acres. So it's it's plenty of room to look around. Yeah. I haven't seen it all yet.
There could be squatters somewhere.
You got to watch out for Billy Beach. He's, you know, he's one of my actors in one of my films. He'd be the one that you'd find him out there and, you know, living off the grid. He could do it.
So I enjoy always your blog or your email blast, whatever the proper term is. And there was one just recently about Adobe bricks. And you titled it, it got my attention right away. So so you have some Adobe bricks that were delivered, I believe.
Yeah, well, I put the order in for the bricks. So it's going to be about 2 months.
Okay.
So these bricks, so Adobe bricks, they dry in the sun to cure. Now, these bricks are called CEB, compressed earth blocks. And basically, it's an Adobe mix, and they hydraulically press them. And so these bricks will last 1,000 years. So we can have those big, crazy rainstorms that happen, you know, in the West, and it won't damage my building. And so I'm building an Adobe barn. So I do some carpentry, some of the the carpentry for the different props and stuff. And so I'll be set up in that. And I also, you know, build a film at the barn. But this is going to be a process. We're doing a rubble trench, which is kind of what the Scottish castles did.
Oh.
It's a trench of gravel underneath. And think of it like a railroad bed. And, you know, the train goes over, the ties are all on this gravel. And, you know, the train is just, I don't know how many tons of weight that is, but the rails don't break and, you know, it just kind of floats on there. And that's what this rubble trench. So as things shift, it's not going to, the adobe blocks won't break up. They'll just kind of be part of the landscape there.
Wow.
So I'm, you know, that's a project I'm doing. I actually have I started a Patreon. I was going to do a documentary on the behind the scenes. And I thought, geez, I'm just wearing too many hats with doing Rio Concho and keeping the books going. And I thought, well, I do want to document the process of, you know, building all these buildings out here in this barn. That's going to be quite the project. And so I started doing little minute segments and doing pictures and posting those on Patreon for Gemini Movie Ranch. And so if people want to follow along, seeing everything that goes into making a movie ranch and doing that, then they can follow along and be a part of it.
Yeah, exciting.
Eric, why is Western storytelling still important today, relevant today, in whether it's printed word, lyric, film? Why is it important?
It's characters. It's the resilience of characters. You know, during COVID, everyone came together and we all survived. And that's what storytelling is the survival stories. And the Western is the perfect place to tell survival stories, because you don't have all this modern day technology, and it's man against nature, man against man. And it's these survival stories are just fascinating. And they can be, you can take a modern day news story and put it in the Old West, and people will listen to it, and they'll understand it in that situation better than they're, you know, in the modern day world where they're actually living it.
Yeah. I'm so delighted to see that there is so much interest. You know, it seems like the West kind of comes in and out of, for some of us, it's always there. Western fashion's always there. Western music's all, you know, it's always there. And then it comes suddenly, the public grabs a hold of it. And we're seeing that with 1923 and with 1883 and with Yellowstone and other projects. I mean, it's really exciting to see so many people grabbing a hold of what we already know is so richly entertaining and also soulful. I mean,
And everyone gets different things out of it. You know, people that enjoy Yellowstone, some of them enjoy the beautiful scenery. Some of them enjoy the characters or the horses.
Right.
You know, my wife, she loves watching Yellowstone, but when they do the 4/6 stuff in North Texas, she's like, I don't want to see the dry Texas. She grew up in Texas. She's like, I want to see the beautiful mountains up there. So for everyone, it's different things. You know?
Yeah. And I think that is, it's such a broad, there's just so much that's covered in the texture of the West and its stories.
1883 was the best thing since Lonesome Dove.
I thought it was just brilliant. I maybe would have ended it a little differently, but he didn't call me. He didn't ask me for any insight. I thought it was brilliant to have a young woman be our voice. And I felt just like, I just thought it was brilliant.
Now, is he going to get in trouble because he's not a young woman and he wrote a young woman's character? You know, you're not supposed to do that these days.
You know what? He got it right on.
I guess if you do it well enough, you don't get in trouble.
I think we have to trust our storytellers, that the creative spirit that moves them and inspires them understands what the story is and the characters' voices. And we as watchers, listeners, and readers, we throw our trust in with those of you that create these works of art. And if I sit back and go, well, really, how would he know about, suddenly the magic is gone. And so that's just,
he did such a fantastic job. He pulled it. I don't know if he has daughters. I'm not sure of his family life, or sisters or whatever, but he just nailed it.
He just nailed it.
You know, the emotions are there, the father-daughter relationship, the mother-daughter relationship.
Yeah.
You know, I have a 13-year-old girl and I see that relationship. You know, yeah. It's just, wow, he just nailed it. And it's well, and then they put in the frontier and everyone watches it. And it's this survival story.
That scene where she plays piano, you know, the piano that gets tossed aside.
Yeah.
And the storytelling, the visual storytelling was just, it was, there were so many powerful moments. The couple of Civil War scenes that were just, you know, riveting. It was just brilliant. And I felt no stereotyping, no cliches, it was felt so fresh, and it made it feel even all the more authentic because it just seemed pure. It just seemed like this is the story.
It was about it. Yeah, it wasn't,
you know?
Yeah, I know what you're saying. having the immigrants and, you know, they're doing the best they can and they're dealing with what they were raised in their culture, and it's a clash, and it's, you know, Sam Elliott's character can't believe that they've come here and to go through this, but he's going to keep them. He's going to try to get them through as best he can. And,
And the stories that they heard in their home that weren't true. They came not knowing we're going to, you know, we can't bring our piano. I mean, they came not really knowing, which is so true for so many that that made the travel. Well, of course, now I am looking at the clock. Oh my goodness. So Eric, how can people find you, follow you, get those wonderful email blasts? Where do they go?
I'm on Instagram under Eric Heisner. My website's www.leandogproductions. So I post a lot of my videos and update stories there once in a while. I have a newsletter sign up, so I send a newsletter out twice a month.
And it's worth it to read it, get it, sign up
for it. I'm glad somebody reads it.
Do you have a quick tip for a writer or a new writer?
Just put in the time, you know, whether it's 5 minutes a day, 10 minutes a day, it adds up. You don't wait for the inspiration. You put the time in and the inspiration comes to you.
Yeah.
So it's, you just putting the time in.
Well, we want to thank our special guest who's going to stay with us to the end here, but we are coming close to the end of our time. We want to thank Eric Heisner, author of Above the Llano and Citation for Murder. You want to read this book. And we just thank you so much, Eric, for being with us tonight.
Our guest
next week returns. We've been on enough weeks that we can actually have somebody come and come back. So next week, Randy Samuelson Brown. Now, she was with us last August, and we talked about her new book at that time, Bram Chaser. She's back with a brand new book, On the Fringes, A Clairvoyant, A Mining Swindle, and A Fresh Start. And I can't wait to start reading
that cover. That's great.
Yeah, that's a nice cover.
Nice cover. She will be with us next week. Next week, we will also talk a little bit about the upcoming Buckaroo Bookshop, and we'll announce the names of all the authors that will be with us. We'll be missing you, Eric. Let's see. You have a quote.
We have a quote.
You have a quote. What is our quote for this week?
This one is from Ernest Hemingway, who says, in order to write about life, first you must live it.
And then you can write it. Well, we thank you all for watching, listening, whether you are with us live tonight or you pick this up as a podcast or you're watching it 6 months from now when you find it on Eric's website or our website or LA Talk Radio's website. We are so delighted that you came along with us, and we will see you again next week, same time, same station. And until then,
remember, it's always a great
day out west. See you.
Thanks.
You're listening to Rendezvous with the Writer with Bobby Jean and Jim Bell, only on LA Talk Radio.